at the gym and they're just pedaling away. And she's always got a great smile. So, yeah,
thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Hey. Hey. Well, I'm so blessed to be here in a room of people that I love and that I know love me. I mean, this is the reason why I have 5.5 years of sobriety. This is it. It's the love that you guys have given me, and that love has turned into spirit. And spirit has allowed me to face calamity with calmness and kindness. And that's a tall order for somebody like myself, that it's a hothead and has a tendency to get feral on occasion. You know, I was kind of worried that I wouldn't have 45 minutes worth of material. And Jack said, well, don't worry about it. There's a 49er game on. So if you get over in 30 minutes, they can all run home and see the 49er game. So I said, well, okay, you know, under those circumstances. And then Kindred reminded me that we're just a room full of drunks. So I'm in a good place. There's no other place that I would like to be, really. My name's Nancy, and I'm an alcoholic. To get some of the, just some of the book work out of the way, my sobriety date is May 25th, 2019. And I have a sponsor, and she has a sponsor, and I have commitments, and I go to at least 4 to 5 meetings a week. And that's because my brain, I have a problem with perception. I have a problem with seeing reality as it really is instead of the reality that I would like to see. And accepting God's reality instead of my reality. I have a difficult time with that. And actually, this is a perfect time for me to speak, because the last 2 weeks I have been filled with fear. And because I've been filled with fear, I know what to do now. I know to reach out. And because I've reached out to the people in this room, they've been able to give me the love and support that I needed when I needed it. And I didn't have to turn to alcohol. And I didn't have to turn to food. And I didn't have to turn to my credit cards, go out shopping, and pretend that I'm powerful. Although I must admit, I drive kind of fast, and if I'm pissed off, I come up right behind you. And Steve reminded me that wasn't a nice thing to do. So anyway, what it was like. I grew up in a family of 6 children. I'm a recovering Catholic as well as a recovering alcoholic. We grew up in Westlake, which is right outside of San Francisco. And there were 3 boys and 3 girls. And my mother had 6 children in the space of 10 years. So there were 3 girls, 3 girls, 3 boys, and I was right in the middle. So my oldest brother is 7 years older than I am. My older sister is 5 years older. I have an older brother that's a cop in Florida. He's retired now, and he's 2 years older. And then there's myself, and I have a younger sister, Maureen, who's 3 years younger, and a younger brother, Kevin. And they're all important in my story. Mom and Dad, they did the best they could, and they did a really good job, I have to say, with the facts that they had. They really believed that education was key in terms of giving us the freedom of choice. My dad wanted to make sure that his daughters always had a choice with what they did with their life, that they never would feel trapped. They didn't have choice, because a lot of times it doesn't feel like you do have choice, but they sent us all to Catholic school. So I went through 8 years of Catholic grammar school, 4 years at Catholic High School, and then 3 years at USF, and then transferred to Berkeley 3 years after that. So I got a lot of Catholicism. And Catholicism works, but it doesn't necessarily help. And I'm more interested in the things that help because they work. And so in the Catholic faith, there's a lot of rules and a lot of regulations. And I always kind of knew that that was just a way to get people to act the way that was kind and loving towards one another. But you wouldn't know that because the Jesuits were always asking for money every time you went to church, you know. So, but they, you know, they needed to keep the whole institution going. And when I was growing up, my mother was really overwhelmed. And she was a beautiful, articulate, kind, compassionate, loving person who, when she drank, she was like Dr. Hyde. So you never knew what mom you were going to get when you came home from school. And it was scary growing up because my dad was a candy salesman. So he raised six kids and put six kids through Catholic school by selling candy. So he really sold a lot of candy. I mean, we're talking about all those pick-a-mix stands that you see in Safeway. And when I was growing up, he had gotten the accounts at Safeway, Lucky, QFI, Long's Drugs, all the way from Monterey all the way up to the Ukiah border. He sold a lot of candy. And he worked really hard, and he traveled a lot, and he was gone a lot because, you know, he was out seeing clients. And my mom was trying to raise these six kids, and she was overwhelmed, and so alcohol became her medicine, like it does. And growing up, it was scary because my dad liked to drink too, and a lot of times they would drink, and then they would get in fights. And then the fights would get physical, and there would be physical violence, to which I remembered, but I didn't know quite what to do with that. So I just remembered on one occasion going up to my oldest sister Barbara's room and saying, "Barbara, what's going on?" And she goes, I love them, but I don't respect them. But there was this, no talk of fear, and there was no talk of sadness. The feelings weren't expressed, but the event was at least acknowledged. And so I remember hanging out, going outside. I would always get outside the house. I would always leave the house. And the reason why I would leave the house, and this is starting at the age of maybe 7 or 8, I would get up and get myself dressed and leave the house. And the reason why I would leave the house is because I wanted to help my mom out. She was overwhelmed. She had a lot on her plate. And I thought, well, at least she won't have to worry about me. I'll just take care of myself, and I can do it by myself. So I kind of grew up and raised myself. And then I remember when I was 11, it was right after Christmas, and my parents had given us a little red wagon, and I took the little red wagon, I sat in the front, I was steering, and my little brother was in the middle, and then we had a neighbor at the end of the little red wagon, and I hit a cyclone fence, and my leg was hanging out, right? So my leg went bump, 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 bump down a fence. I ran into a fence. So I shattered the two bones in my leg, and I was in a wheelchair. I had a cast up to my hip for 6 months. 3 months of that, I was in a wheelchair. And then the last 3 months, I had a walking cast. And the reason why I bring this up is because my mother was there to take care of me. Is that my phone? No? No, okay. I thought maybe it might have been my phone. And she was there, you know. So as I go through healing from this disease, I'm starting to have kinder, nicer memories of Mom, because initially I had the awful memories. And now that I'm doing some healing around those memories, I'm starting to get more of the good memories. And I'm telling you all this because my mom was really articulate. She had a really good way with words, and she was really a good public speaker. So half of my genes are my mother's genes. And even though she never made it to AA, she's here now. I was home for 6 months during that broken leg episode. And then the next year, I was in the seventh grade, and I had a nun named Sister Marie de Chantal. And Sister Marie de Chantal noticed that I was dissociating a lot. I was dreaming a lot. I would just kind of float off in my mind to some place that was fun and safe and just a nice place to be. And she noticed that. And so she came up to me one day and she said, "You know, Nancy, you're really good at this." And I remember looking at this nun going, "Really?" And she goes, "Yeah, you're really good at that." And because she gave me positive attention for doing something that I was good at, I decided that I was going to do more of that because I wanted more positive attention, right? So I learned at the age of 12 that if you were studying hard and you were smart and you did the right things, then you would get positive attention. So I went from being a D student to a straight A student because of the attention and the love that that nun. Now, I know that a lot of people have horrible nun stories, and I have a few of those myself. But this nun, because of the love and the light that she gave me, she changed my life. I went from trying to get negative attention to getting positive attention. And I worked as hard as I could, and she acknowledged that. You know, with the Catholics, they have all of these processions, you know, for St. Mary and everything, you know, and I got to carry the crown on May Day for the Blessed Virgin Mary, you know, and it was just like big stuff for an 11-year-old kid, you know, 12-year-old kid. Anyway, eventually, when I turned 14, my mother was getting progressively more ill. And when she would drink, she'd get mean, and she would say mean things. So I was avoiding her a lot towards the end. But then there came a day when my older sister found my mother in the bathroom vomiting blood. She had esophageal varices. So these little tiny capillaries around your esophagus, they rupture and you bleed into your stomach. And she was throwing up all kinds of blood. So I remember this like it was yesterday. My sister's talking to the doctor, and he's saying, "Are you sure it's blood?" And she goes, "It's not cranberry juice." And she just, you know, off came the ambulance and picked her up. And I was 15, and I remember I was really struggling. And again, you know, the way I coped with all this is I disassociated, so I would just go off someplace. But I also could bring it back in and study. And I would bring it back in to study, and then I would go off. And then I remember this one nun named Sister Michelle came up to me one day, and she goes, "God, you look miserable. Are you always so miserable?" And the next day, my mother died. And I said, "I'm sorry, sister. I apologized for the way I was feeling." And when Mom died, I eventually went back to school maybe a week later. And she said, "I'm so sorry. I had no idea." And I said, "That's okay, sister." I let myself cry for about 3 days. And then after 3 days, I couldn't cry anymore. I had cried enough tears. And so I just thought, well, I'm just going to distract myself. So I'm going to go to school, and I'm going to get straight A's, and I'm going to prove that I have value. When I was growing up, my value was based on performance because people pointed out when I had good grades, they rewarded me for good grades. And so I worked really hard on my grades. And before my mother died, my dad went to St. Mary's. And on her deathbed, she told my dad that all her girls were going to have a white wedding. She wanted them to have china and silver and crystal. And she told my dad, the biggest thing in a kid's life is Christmas and their birthday. So I want you to know that you've got to make sure that the Christmas is really big, Halloween is really big, and their birthdays are really big. So she essentially told him how to raise us. And she said, but one thing I'm leaving you is good kids. And so after she died, my sisters and I just stepped up to the plate. You know, we just started cooking dinner, doing the grocery shopping, cleaning the house. You know, 15 years old, I'm getting straight A's, I'm cleaning the house, I'm cooking meals. I mean, I'm like a 44-year-old woman in a 15-year-old child's body, right? And that's the way it was all the way through school, except when I got into college, then I started working on the weekends. So there wasn't a lot of downtime. There wasn't a lot of play time. There wasn't any time to relax. I'm not sure that I felt entirely safe, but I just remember feeling a lot of fear all the time. And when I found alcohol, all that fear went away. I would have a couple of beers. We'd all, in high school, we'd go to football games. And I would have a couple of beers before the football game. And all of a sudden, I could be a kid. I could giggle. I could laugh. I could enjoy myself. I didn't have the fear. The alcohol knocked out the fear. So guess what I did with alcohol? I drank every chance I got because it was fun, right? So I didn't screw up my grades or anything like that. I went to college, and my dad said, you're going to go to college, and you're going to pay for it. So I paid for my college education by working at Macy's on the weekends and taking out loans. So I wanted to make sure that I could take care of myself and that I got a job so that I could pay off my loans, right? And I started off in nursing because I always knew I wanted to go into medicine. There was just something about medicine that made sense to me, and I loved it. So I started off in nursing, and then I worked in a hospital for a couple of years, and I decided I couldn't deal with nursing. I couldn't deal with it. It was just any nurses in this room, I got to tell you, I have so much respect for you because I've tried to do it, and I can't do it. But I had a girlfriend who, she was going to be a dietitian, and she was going to go to UC Berkeley. So I said, well, what does a dietitian do? I had no idea. And she said, well, they talk about food. And I said, great. I was talking about food all the time anyway, you know. And I thought, oh, I'm going to get paid for talking about food. This is great, you know. But I loved it. It was a fit just from the start. And when people would ask me, you know, they'd ask me about my background or something. And they'd say, well, what happened to your mom? I'd say, oh, she died of cancer. And I'd just leave it at that because I didn't want to get into the specifics. And I'm not really sure that I understood the specifics anyway. But one day, I'm at a lecture on cirrhosis of the liver. It's a nutrition class, and they talk about liver failure and what happens in liver failure. And they talked about how people become foggy-brained and lose their mentation. And they talked about the esophageal varices, and they talked about the ascites when you see somebody that has a swollen stomach. She had that. She had the esophageal varices. They talked about malnutrition, how your liver processes everything that you eat. So everything that you eat goes to your liver first, and your liver decides what in the body needs what. So it will wrap up any vitamin and send it off to where it needs to go. So if you have liver failure and your liver isn't working, it won't go anywhere. It'll just sit there in your gut, right? So malnutrition is a part of end-stage alcoholism and cirrhosis. And I remember the last time I saw my mom, her eyes were sunken in the back of her head. Her skin just hung on her face. She had, like, no muscle. The skin was just falling from her bones. And I remember getting on a bus and going to the Haight-Ashbury, because the Haight-Ashbury was 2 blocks from St. Mary's Hospital. So I went to the Haight-Ashbury. I went in a head shop. I went in and I got this little ring that was made out of a reed. It was braided. And I bought it for my mom. And I went to the hospital and I was going to give it to her, except that she was there, but she wasn't there. She was in a coma. And I remember looking at her and thinking, I don't understand. How is it that in 1967, a woman can die of malnutrition in a hospital bed? It didn't make sense to me. So lo and behold, I graduate from Cal. I become a dietitian. I get a job at Ralph K. Davies Hospital in San Francisco, and I started working in a dialysis unit. And the guys that ran the dialysis unit were the doctors that engineered the artificial kidney machine. So this doctor had a way of looking at blood tests, and he could mathematically figure out how much protein did someone have to eat to produce that amount of garbage. So when you eat a carb or you eat a fat, it's broken down into carbon dioxide, which you can breathe off, and water, which you can pee off. But when you eat protein, you have a nitrogen compound. Nitrogen makes everything strong. And this nitrogen compound, you got to get rid of. And that's what your kidneys do. They filter the nitrogen compounds out. So this doctor had figured out a way that you could look at somebody's blood tests and figure out how much protein did they have to burn to produce that rise in their urea nitrogen in their blood. So I was working in a hospital. I could tell how much protein people were burning up. And a lot of times these people were not being fed. So there's only one place it can come from, and that's from your muscle tissue or from your organ tissue or from your skin. And I would follow people that were not eating. They were on IVs, and they had multiple surgeries, which meant their body was under a lot of physiologic stress and not eating. And a lot of these people didn't have good appetites to begin with. So when they came into the hospital, they were just skin and bones. And I remember this one guy, I just had a horrible feeling about him, because he hadn't eaten for a week, had 3 surgeries, and he was like 45 kilos, which is about 90 pounds. And I went up to this medical director, and I said, I'm really concerned about this guy because he's been here for a week, he hasn't eaten, and I just think he's going to bite the dust. And so this scientist looked at me, and he goes, that's a clever compound. What do you mean bite the dust? What do you mean exactly? What, scientifically, what are you saying to me? I said, I think he's gonna die. And his doctor laughed at me, but the medical director said, thank you for telling me, Nancy. And I came back to the work on a Monday, and this gentleman had ended up on a respirator because he had been using his intercostal and his diaphragm muscles as an energy source. He had been breaking down those proteins and using those proteins as an energy source, which meant he didn't have the power to breathe. I called it before it happened. And so after that, they put this guy on liquid nutrition in his veins, and they brought him back, and he lived for another couple of years. And after I did that, all the doctors, under that doctor's rule, anytime I said, I'm concerned about so-and-so, they'd say, fine, Nancy, do it whatever you want. Just do it, right? So this doctor also was the son of an alcoholic father. And he worked really, really hard to create this medical environment in which nutrition was really important. And usually you don't find that in medicine. Nutrition is important in some areas of medicine, but in not all areas of medicine. But he said, Nancy, the work that you're doing is great. I want you to go back to Boston and present your work at the National Kidney Foundation. And I'm like, I'm like, you don't know who you're talking to, you know, like, I don't think so. He said, no, you can do this. I know you can do this. And I'm like 28 years old. And I had been dating this guy since college, and I realized that I couldn't focus enough on this project if I was still dating this guy, because I knew there was something that wasn't right. I knew I wasn't going to stay with him long term. So I decided to break up with him and focus on giving this talk. And I realized that alcohol would get in the way, because I realized if I drank alcohol, I wouldn't be able to focus on this project. So I stopped drinking. I was 28 years old, and I went to Our Lady of Angels Church in Burlingame for 3 months. And I went, and I was so scared. I just hung on to the podium like this, and I shook from the top of my head to my feet. But I presented this abstract. And once I realized that I wasn't going to die, I kind of got used to public speaking. And so after that opportunity, I started doing a lot of public speaking. And I enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun. The juice that got me through delivering that project was I realized that what happened to my mom was a tragedy, but that I understood at an emotional level why nutrition was important. And I realized that God wanted me to do this. I didn't want to do it because I didn't think I had the power to do it, but God wanted me to do it, so I did it, right? And once I learned that I could go to God and ask for God for help, then I started going to God more often. However, my drinking still took off. I was professionally successful, but my drinking was still taken off. And by the age of 37, I was living in Redwood Shores, and I had a little kitten named Muffin. And Muffin was maybe about 6 months old, and I used to open up the kitchen window so Muffin could hop out the window and play on the roof. There was a tree outside, could play on the tree. And I had blacked out and closed the window, and so Muffin couldn't get back in. And when I woke up, I saw this little kitten doing this on the window, scratching to get in. And I looked at that kitten, and I had a flashback of what it was like to come home from school and see my mother. She was there, but she wasn't there. And I was on my bed, passed out. I was there, but I wasn't there. And I realized if I could do it to a kitten, I could do it to a child. And I would not allow what was done to me, I would not allow myself to repeat it. So the next day, I called the outpatient department at Stanford Hospital, and I said, I need help. And that was the beginning, and that was in 1987. So I got into treatment, and I started going to meetings, and I went to a lot of meetings, and I got a sponsor, and I worked the steps. But I really didn't think, it's like I've heard Kindred say this, you know, here I'm coming to you with a problem, and you're telling me how to decorate my garden. You know, I'm not understanding any of this. What do these steps have to do with anything? But I, you know, I did everything that people told me to do. And then I used to go to this one meeting in Foster City called the Foster City Living Sober Group. And I walked in, and one day this guy walks in, and I went, hubba, hubba. Who's that? And so Jack and I, we were introduced. And we started going out, and it was just like we would complete each other's sentences. Like I would say something, he goes, I was just about to say that. Or he would say something, I'd say, you know, it was just, we were just hooked up together somehow. And the child in me loves to play with the child in Jack. We have a lot of fun together. And because of Alcoholics Anonymous, we're going to be celebrating our 33rd wedding anniversary, November 30th of this year. Yeah. Alcoholics Anonymous is really wonderful for helping you learn your part in a relationship. So if the relationship is going good, take a look at what you're doing. If the relationship isn't, you know, we have our disagreements, and he can point things out to Jack can see my blind spots, and I can see his blind spots. So he can point out to me things that I can't see in myself. And that's the same with Sue. Sue can see things in me that I can't see for myself. And that's why it's important to have a sponsor. That's why it's important to have friends. Because there's our character defects, we can't see them. We're blind to them, right? And so when someone can point that out, and you can say, okay, now I know what to work with, the relationship can get stronger. So I really credit Alcoholics Anonymous with the success of our marriage. As you know, I didn't stay sober because other things became more important than my sobriety. There's no other way to put it. No other way to put it. What was important to me was I was self-employed. By this time, I was self-employed, and I was doing a lot of public speaking, and I was running around and doing really well, but I lost track of what was really important. And I would say that that's why I didn't keep my sobriety. And what happened is that in 2018, I noticed that I started getting nauseated after meals. And that's not a good sign. That meant, to me, that meant that my liver was getting inflamed. So an inflamed liver is the beginning of cirrhosis of the liver. Your liver gets inflamed, and then in cirrhosis, what happens is that your body starts to lay down scar tissue instead of healthy. Now, the good news is that if you do have cirrhosis of the liver, that you can reverse it. Because if you just have a little bit of healthy liver tissue, you can regrow a healthy liver. So that's the good news about that. And I knew that too, but I remember we were down in Southern California, and it was like 2018, and I remember I drank a bottle of wine, and I didn't feel it. And so I drank another bottle of wine, and I still didn't feel it. And I remember the next day getting up just feeling really nauseated, and I had a couple of pieces of toast, and I just felt sick, just absolutely sick. So we're in an Uber, and we're driving back to the airport, and I'm counting because I didn't want to throw up. And I was really working hard at keeping my mind off of my stomach, right? So I realized that I was going downhill and that I needed help. And so I was now working at a senior support in Pleasanton. And at senior support, we were taking care of elderly people who would need to stay in their homes. And we would help them stay in their homes. And we had a new boss, and I had the personality of an alcoholic. I didn't listen to directions. I thought I knew everything. I had a lot of character defects. And what happened is I was written up for my behavior. And luckily for me, there was a woman that worked at senior support who walked with dignity. She didn't gossip. She was really straight with people. She was very kind, just very loving. And when I got written up, she knew that I had gotten written up. And she said, "Nancy, you okay?" And I said, "I just don't want to drink." And I knew that there was something different about Jeannie, because Jeannie worked the steps. Jeannie didn't drink, and she worked the steps. And I realized that the reason why I was how I was, it was because I didn't. And that I needed to work the steps if I wanted to move forward. I wasn't drinking, but I was acting like an active alcoholic, and I needed to work the steps to get past that. So I called up Marty, and some of you have heard of Marty. Marty was my first sponsor when I came back in 2019. I chose Marty because Marty worked the steps, she had a sponsor, she had a lot of service, and I liked the way she moved. I would have asked Jeannie, because Jeannie was in the program, but Jeannie was taking care of her mom who had Parkinson's disease and was going downhill. And I didn't want to put one more thing on her plate. So I asked Marty because I knew that Marty scared me. And if Marty asked me to do something, I would do it. because I didn't want to deal with the consequences, right? So she said, you're going to call me every day for 30 days. You're going to go to these meetings, and you're going to work the steps. And so I would go to her house every Tuesday night. I worked the steps with Marty. And I think I was sober for maybe a year when Marty was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And Marty's a nurse. And Marty was a very strong lady, called her sponsor, and when she found out of her diagnosis, and her sponsor said, well, let's not just plan the funeral yet, shall we? And Marty was diagnosed in 2020, and Marty is still with us today. I just ran into her at the elections that were down in Livermore. So Marty, the reason why she's here, I'm sure, is because she gives hope to people who have a hopeless disease. She gives hope to me to this day. As Marty became sicker, and I realized that she couldn't, she was having a hard time staying alive. So I asked Sue to be my sponsor, because I'm a person that I need to be accountable. I need to report to somebody. And left to my own devices, I won't do the steps unless I commit to doing the steps and I commit to doing these things. So I committed to doing these things. And we got out the 12 by 12 and we started reading the 12 by 12 and working the steps. And being able to see my part in it, of all situations, has helped me tremendously. But these days, I have been feeling a lot of fear. And so I have been following directions of what everyone in the program tells me to do. Pray. I get up and I pray. A lot of people complain about, or not complain, but a lot of people say, well, I have a hard time with God. I've never had a hard time with God. I really, when I visualize God, I visualize a mother looking at her newborn baby. My understanding, I've never had children, but I've watched mothers with newborn babies, and they are absolutely in love with their baby. And I look at God like God is absolutely in love with all of us. He really wants me to succeed because God, I'm doing God's work. He's working through us. He's working through each and every one of us, right? So I have to pray to remember that because I forget that. I have to breathe. The blessing of COVID is that I watched people who did not survive because they could not breathe. Something so basic, so simple, something that we all take for granted. These people were struggling to get a respirator and to survive. So during COVID, I used to sit out in my backyard and I started following my breath, following it in and exhaling, following it in and exhaling. And what I realized is as I was following my breath, I began to kind of watch myself in everyday situations. I was able to watch my behavior. Meditation for me happened when all I did was focus on my breath and how much I appreciated and was grateful for my breath. So the more I did that, the more relaxed I became. And the more relaxed I became, the longer time just seemed to slow down so that I began to see my own behavior in action as I was living my life. And to this day, when I go out and walk and I'm in nature, God lifts me up so that I can watch myself in real time. I can watch my life in real time. I can watch the behaviors of what I'm doing and what I'm thinking and what I'm feeling so that now I can better identify what I'm thinking and feeling and watch my actions. So meditation was huge because it showed me how I can fall back into my own story. And what gets me out of my story is reaching out and being helpful to other people. So Jack and I, 3 years ago, Jack, we had to retire. And we were up in Spokane, and we had never talked about retirement before. We had never talked about the finances. We had never talked about what we were going to do with our home, none of that. So we were up in Spokane, and we had this conversation, and it was clear that Jack's health was in question, our finances were in question, and I was no longer going to be able to live in my home. So I sat out on the stoop of this Airbnb in Spokane, and I said, God, I'm fucked. I'm out of power here. I mean, there's nothing I can do. I am totally surrendering to you. Do with me as you will, because I'm no longer running the show. And I took a walk in this park, and I had a memory of me when I was 3 years old. And during COVID, we all had to stay 6 feet away from each other. Remember? We all had to keep our distance. And so when I would be in Safeway or I would be anywhere, I would feel like I was in people's way all the time. And that feeling of being in someone's way really bothered me. So I went to Marty. I said, Marty, I just really feel bothered. I just really feel like I'm in people's way. And she said, well, why don't you write about that? So I said, okay. So I wrote about it, right? So I'm up in Spokane at the park, and I'm having this meeting, this memory. And I remembered my mom was trying to diaper my younger sister, Maureen, and I was on the bed, and she pushed me off the bed. And I remember looking at her thinking, I'm not as important. The feeling was, I don't have value. That was the feeling. I'm not worthy. And I realized she didn't mean to make me feel that way. She was overwhelmed. So I was my mother, overwhelmed, and I was a three-year-old child at the same time, which is really freaky. But it was the only way that God could show me forgiveness and compassion. I had no compassion for myself. The reason why I kept on going out is because of shame. I did not feel bad. I was bad. And that shame, I believe, came because my poor mom didn't have the time to reflect back to me what I was feeling and to teach me how to deal with those feelings. She didn't have the time. She had too many kids and too few hands, and she just couldn't do it. So I grew up not being able to identify what I was feeling, let alone what to do with them. So that's what I learned here. I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm in Montessori school for adults, right? I went to a woman's retreat. Debbie Davis gave this retreat, and I remember I was not real excited about going to a retreat with a lot of women because I've never hung out with a lot of women before. I've always hung out with the guys, not the girls. And I went into the meeting and I felt less than, and I wasn't the same, and I wasn't worthy, and I was mad. I was angry. I'm writing, right? I'm just writing. And spinning, right? Because I'm not feeling bad. I am bad, right? So I'm really pissed off, and I'm writing. So Marty wasn't there because Marty was sick, but I went to her sober sister, and I said, Sheila, I'm really spinning. And she said, oh, well, that's okay. Here, let's find you something to do. And she turned around, she goes, Nancy, sit over at this table and start selling books. So I sat at the table, and I started selling books, and I got it. I finally got it. How do you get out of yourself? You help other people. That's how you get out of yourself. I sold books for an hour. I was feeling great after that hour. Yay, you know? So I learned that service is what saves us. Getting out of ourself is what saves us. So armed with that knowledge, Jack and I were looking for a place to live 3 years ago. We're sitting at States. We went, gone to the museum, and we're sitting there, and I'm looking around, and I'm thinking, I really like it here. You know, this is a really cute little town. The people look friendly. It looked really diverse. It looked like a wonderful place to live. So I'm going with the feeling, right? I'm noticing a feeling, right? I'm noticing. So the next day, I pick up the phone. I call a girl that I gave her first job 12 years ago. I call her up. I say, do you know any realtors in Benicia? She goes, yeah, my friend Carla. She gave me Carla's number. I called Carla. Carla said, well, there's not any homes available now, but you ought to look in Glen Cove because Glen Cove has more homes that open up and they're not as expensive. So I said, great. So I'm out in the backyard, and this is a horrible time to buy a house because everybody's paying for houses $200,000 over asking. I mean, it was just a horrible time. And so we're in Modesto, putting all cash offers in a Modesto. And then we're in Auburn. And every time we'd put in an offer over asking, it would, you know, we would be outbid. So I'm getting frustrated, and I'm sitting out in my backyard where I used to practice meditation. And I'm telling God, and God says, I know you don't have a house. You don't tell me that. Why don't you tell me what you do want? That's what God said. So I'm sitting in the chair, and I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to think about a house that I saw the backyard, and this backyard looked over the Carquinez Strait, and there was Port Costa in the background, there was Carquinez Strait, and then you could see Benicia. And I'm thinking of this, and I'm thinking of this house, and I'm meditating, and I'm saying to myself, God, I just want peace and serenity. That's all I want is peace and serenity. But I'm thinking of this view. Well, Carla shows us a house in Glen Cove that's 200 feet from the Carquinez Strait. You look over, and there's Port Costa. And son of a gun, we found the house that I had envisioned during my meditation. So we come and start going to meetings, and I feel like a duck out of water, right? I mean, I just feel like, okay, I know all these people. Started going to meetings. I felt really familiar with everyone from the beginning. I just felt like I was at home. So I started getting commitments. And because I got the commitments, I started meeting everybody. And I was really busy. I was so busy, I didn't have time to feel sorry for myself. I didn't have time to worry about Jack. I didn't have time to worry about the fight. I mean, I was just too busy, right? And I just kind of feel like God has caught me and placed me in a bucket of love, in a bucket of spirit, in a world where people live to be of service. People live to be helpful. It's just, you have no idea how wonderful this community is. If you've ever lived anywhere else, and I have, I can tell you, in the Tri-Valley and in other areas, there's a lot of fear, and there's a lot of working really hard to make the car payments and the house payments and the school payments and the this payments and the that payments. When I got here to Benicia, people are doing all that, but they also acknowledge what's going on inside, how to identify it, how to, well, Liz will say it, I think, I feel, I need. I would say it as I used to think, feel, act. And now what I do is think, act, feel. So I think, but then I get into action. And as long as it's God's action, I have nothing to worry about. Because then if it's God's action, I feel good, right? So I know how to get out of myself now by being of service with you. And I know how to identify what I need, not all the time, but I can reach out to people now and say, I just feel funny. I'm the emotional sobriety. I read a book by Ernie Larson, Stage 2 Recovery. And stage 1 recovery is when we quit drinking. And then stage 2 recovery is when you start to appreciate your own self-defeating behaviors when you're doing them, when you're in action. So you start learning about the people-pleasing, martyrdom, all the things that get in our way. And so that's the stuff that I'm working on today. I'm working on getting out of myself, being of service, and most of all, being grateful. Gratitude, I have a wonderful community. I have a wonderful husband. I have a wonderful family. I have wonderful friends. I am blessed beyond imagination. So I want to thank everybody here in this room for all the love and support that you've given me, because you and God have made a difference in my life. So I hope I've said something helpful to you today. That's it. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Aww.